This program is sponsored by BMO Wealth Management, Tyrone and Ann Fainer, Yon LLC, Reed Smith, the Satter Foundation, and the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund. The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
Welcome to Pritzker Military Presents, featuring my discussion with historian and award-winning writer and editor Michael Robbins to discuss the Pritzker Military Museum and Library's latest publication, Lest We Forget the Great War. I'm your host, Ken Clark, and also the executive editor and creative director of Lest We Forget the Great War. This program is coming to you from the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago, and it's sponsored by BMO Wealth Management, Tyrone and Ann Fainer, Yon LLC, Reed Smith, the Satter Foundation, and the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund. This program and hundreds more are available on demand at PritzkerMilitary.org. Published in partnership with the United States World War I Centennial Commission, on the occasion of the United States World War I Centennial, Lest We Forget the Great War is a tribute to the doughboys and sailors who served and the allies they fought beside to defeat a deadly enemy. Inspired by the Museum and Library's robust World War I collection, the book features 166 World War I posters, as well as photographs, maps, and a taut narrative by Michael Robbins about the history of the war from 1914 to the 1920s. An official product of the United States World War I Centennial Commission, proceeds from this book will help build the new National World War I Memorial in Washington, D.C. The book's companion exhibit, Lest We Forget, Sailors, Sammies, and Doughboys Over There in World War I, at the Museum and Library, features an exploration of the United States' involvement in World War I and the experiences of doughboys in the trenches. Michael Robbins served as editor of MHQ, the Quarterly Journal of Military History, and was also editor of Military History Magazine and Audubon Magazine. He serves as an editor and writer for many of the Museum and Library's publications. Robbins has a PhD in American history from George Washington University. Please join me in welcoming to the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, Michael Robbins.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Before we start the discussion, we're going to roll a video that will tell you a little bit more about our project over here.
Lest We Forget, The Great War is an illustrated story about World War I, published upon the occasion of the United States Centennial of the Great War. The book is a resource for those who want to learn about this war, the first truly global conflict in history. The war was unprecedented in size, scope, cost, destruction, casualties, and social and economic impact. It quite literally changed our world and the course of our civilization. It destroyed old empires and nations and created whole new nations. Its effects on the many nations that participated and their relationships with each other continue to reverberate today, a century after the final shot was fired. This epic struggle is approached through the powerful and memorable art it spawned and the timely period photographs that illustrate the awful realities of this revolutionary conflict. Most importantly, the book is a tribute to the doughboys and sailors who served and the allies they fought beside to defeat a resourceful and implacable enemy force. It also serves as a lasting reminder that the world ignores the history of World War I at its peril. Lest we forget.
Well, Michael, when it comes to the topic of World War I, Americans have probably heard about the assassination of Franz Ferdinand. They've probably heard about the American reluctance to join the war, and then the very swift and bloody American entrance into the war that basically led to a very quick resolution of it. Mm-hmm. However, all of this stuff that's happened through the lens of history, it takes on kind of an aura of inevitability. And yet, for the leaders of the time, World War I was anything but an inevitable war. Isn't that correct?
Yes, inevitable and unpredictable. One of the drawbacks of, if there is one, of history is that in hindsight it always seems inevitable, But it must, in the early summer of 1914, it must have seemed anything but inevitable. No one was really, well, let me revise that. There was a lot of militarism in the air. There had been wars, the Balkan War, the Franco-Prussian War, the Russo-Japanese War. It wasn't that nobody had fired a shot for any significant period of time. But there were some misconceptions about what warfare was at that time in the technological sense. And also in terms of just being prepared to actually go ahead and fight a war, it's arguable that the Germans were probably the best prepared, but nobody was really prepared. They didn't have, they had plans. France had its Plan 17 and Germany had its Schlieffen Plan. But the Plan 17 was a terrible idea, and the Schlieffen Plan was derailed immediately, almost immediately, by its own generals. So it was a time when there was enormous confusion, and I think a lot of the literature has made it very clear that, you know, while there were this sort of sense of dominoes falling and you know, the war expanding outward, but it really was astounding the extent to which there was misgiving and doubt, and the Austrians really kicked it off by declaring war on the Serbians, but it took them a month to get around to that, and there was a lot of talk and a lot of conversation and push and pull. But once with all those entangling alliances, as I'm sure most of you know, once one country declared war on another with all the alliances, there were declarations of war going back and forth very quickly, and the fighting, you know, got going in a big way by the end of the summer.
So on the morning before World War I, the world was neatly organized into often contested, but, you know, colonial territories, yeah, by the world's powers.
Yeah.
And these often contested areas, you've already mentioned it, with some of the wars that you mentioned, but those wars didn't, like the Russo-Japanese War or the Balkan Wars, those didn't trigger a great war. So what was different about World War I that this triggered all that other stuff?
Well, the alliances came into play, and that was a big factor, but also the very fact that these were colonial powers, and they had resources to draw upon, and they also had, you know, manpower among them, and they also had situations where in the colonies they were in conflict with some of the European powers, were in conflict with one another, the Germans and the Brits, most pronouncedly in sub-Saharan Africa, but the spread to a global war, I think, was really triggered in a sense by the sheer size of the armies that were in question here and the speed with which they could mobilize. The Russians had an enormous army. The Germans, I think one of the things that is often forgotten, when the Germans swept into Belgium in executing the Schlieffen Plan and, you know, trying to flank the French line, they hit Belgium with 1 million men. This isn't starting out at the skirmish level. This is starting out with a really full-blown, large army. And when the Russians were going to mobilize, they were able to mobilize, well over 1 million, close to 2 million. And the Germans were very concerned about that, so they, in a sense, struck first. But these were huge armies, and the huge armies, you know, really accelerated the pace of the expansion of the war.
So in order for them to actually mobilize that, they had to have labor and they had to have industry and they had to have a lot of different things in play. What was the world looking like at that time?
Well, it was those things were very unevenly distributed. The Germans had a fabulous railroad network, which made its presence known very early in the war. The Russians were quite behind. I think it's often said about the Russians that they had numbers, but they lacked almost everything else you needed to conduct a major war. They didn't have much of a road network. They had just not too long before the war broke out, they had entered into a deal with a friend, their allies, the French, to have a French-built railroad network, but they just got going on that. And the Germans were aware of that, and I think if they were thinking, sooner or later we're going to have to fight the Russians, maybe we better fight them before they have a good rail network. Because that was one of the rail network is one of the things that allowed the Germans to score such an astounding victory in the first big battle they fought with the Russians at Tannenberg, or near Tannenberg. So
it spread to the Middle East and into China and Japan. What do you think fueled that growth of the war?
Well, I think it was some of the alliances. I don't think it's all that well known that Japan had treaty obligations with Britain. And so when the war broke out, and again, this may not be all that widely known either, there were German enclaves, you know, in China, and at the time China was a very weak state, and there were European sort of trading enclaves and so on that were partially militarized for, I guess, security reasons. But there was a German military presence on mainland China, and the Japanese immediately began attacking that because they were interested in extending their influence in Japan. And the a really interesting historical note here, I think this is probably not all that widely known, is that the Germans had, as part of their late start in forming colonies around the globe, did have possession of a number of islands and island chains in the Pacific, named the Marianas, the Carolines, names that became very famous in World War II when the U.S. Army, Navy, and Marines and airmen had to conquer those islands. They were German protectorates or territories at the time the war broke out, and the Japanese got them as part of the end of the end settlement of World War I. So the Japanese were very much an interested party, although, you know, the war is really thought of as a European war. It was not a European, not just a European war. It really spread far and wide and rapidly.
So in my explorations about World War I, one thing that always surprises me is just how quickly it became surprisingly brutal and devastating to officers and foot soldiers alike. You know, you had large groups of men from both sides being annihilated by all sorts of different kinds of tools of war. New technology was used to attack both sides, yeah. and even attacking civilian populations. So what events stand out in your mind that really drove this to be so quickly brutal?
Well, I think, you know, in many cases we're talking very big armies. And if you're talking very big armies, you're talking big casualty lists. I mean, if you're talking big armies colliding with other big armies, then you are talking big casualty lists. And I think one of the first, there are also a sense of, you know, calculation or miscalculation in what the tactics were. But in the very earliest days of the shooting in World War I, the Battle of the Frontiers, the Germans were advancing, you know, into Belgium. And they had strong defensive positions at the point where the French thought they were going to attack France. So the first thing the French did was mount a very hastily conceived and you know, poorly worked out attack on a German a line of German defenses that was very very well formed and powerfully defended. And the result was, well, the French were also attacking with weapons that would have been and tactics that would have been more appropriate to the glory days of the Napoleonic Wars. The French attacked in this first part of the Battle of the Frontiers. And within, I think, two, maybe 3 days, the Germans, from their well-defended positions, inflicted 140,000 casualties on the French army. It's arguable that they may have done the army something of a favor by killing off a high percentage of the most veteran French officers. But in any case, it was a terrible shock to the French nation. Nobody was prepared for casualties on that scale. And, you know, the slaughter started early and it really never stopped.
But most of the people thought this war was going to be short.
They did. That's one of the unpredictable and surprising things about the war. No one was prepared. None of the belligerents was prepared to fight a long war. They really all thought in terms of a short war. Sadly, some factions in some of the countries thought of it as sort of a sporting kind of event. Had a game quality. You can see this in the British propaganda about the early days of the war. No one was prepared. No one had the resources or the money or the supply lines to conduct a really long campaign. The British weren't the only ones that thought, this thing is going to be over by Christmas, and they were openly talking about that. They were all thinking in terms of warfare as a matter of weeks. And, in defense of that idea, some of the fighting in earlier wars that they would have been most familiar with, the Franco-Prussian War and the Balkan Wars, they were fairly short. No one could have imagined that this thing was going to drag on for years and just engulf so much of their populations. And so they planned for a short one, and they were wrong.
What are some of the surprises you ran into about this early devastating war that they entered in that they thought was going to be short but then wasn't?
Well,
the way the war was conducted, and losers early on.
That was one, and I think one of the things that struck me as most surprising is how resistant to recognizing the impacts of technology on the conduct of war, on the weapons. How reluctant so many of the officers, especially the British, and to some extent the French as well, and later the Germans, they didn't realize how much warfare should have changed. If they had been paying better attention, to the American Civil War, and certainly to the Russo-Japanese War, they might have had a better idea of what the impacts of technological innovations were going to have. But at the beginning of the war, no one saw aircraft as being a significant weapons system. Maybe for reconnaissance, that's it. But the planes were a little better than motorized kites at the beginning. They quickly evolved into something much more sophisticated and deadly, but they weren't that way at the beginning. But there were weapons that really were modern weapons that were available, and many of the planners of the war in the general corps should have realized made this a different kind of war. I mean, it doesn't seem that anyone really predicted the effects of barbed wire. And the rapid development of rapid-fire weapons. My favorite illustration of that is the famous French 75, which later gained renown as a cocktail, of course, but it as an actual weapon, the Model 97 field piece with an innovative recoil control system that enabled it to fire. I've seen up to 20 rounds a minute. I kind of doubt that they often achieved that, but it was a significant rapid-fire weapon. Flat trajectory, if you were in sight of your target, it was a very deadly weapon, although, 75 is fairly small. But, these weapons, a weapon like that and the heavy water-cooled machine guns, they just transformed the battlefield. I mean, it wasn't Napoleonic anymore, and it wasn't sharpshooters kind of thing. It was mass killing. It was mechanized, industrialized mass killing. And it took a lot of people a long time to get the hang of that. It may or may not be apocryphal, but it's often said that General Douglas Haig considered the machine gun a passing fad, and thought it it really couldn't stop a well-conducted cavalry charge. I don't know what his horses were wearing, but horses don't do well in the path of 50 caliber machine guns.
You've mentioned in previous conversations about a Austrian unit that's up in the mountains.
Oh,
and yeah. And this seems to be a good story for this misconception of what the war was.
Yes, one of the least prepared, one of the earliest, deadliest engagements was the so-called Winter War, and that occurred in the Carpathian Mountains between the Russians and the Austro-Hungarian Army. This was an ill-considered fight in a territory that was completely unsuited to conduct any kind of combat. There were almost no roads. There was one meandering railroad that didn't go really near close enough to be of any much effect. And the Austrian army had an outpost, a fortress that had been surrounded by the Russians. They wanted to liberate it. And they started throwing enormous numbers of men eventually to reach the million mark and over at recapturing this fort, which has got it has a name that I can't pronounce, begins with a P and an R, but Prismol or something. But it's the fighting over that was conducted in the most primitive kinds of conditions. The Austrians didn't have appropriate uniforms. They didn't have enough weapons. They had almost no transport. They had almost no way of treating wounded. They had very poor supply lines. People were starving. And to me, the anecdote that kind of sums it all up and gives you an idea of both the horror and the context in which it was occurring is that there were verified stories of wounded soldiers being devoured by wolves. You know, I came across that in an article by Dennis Showalter, who's a wonderful historian, and I was so struck by it, I called him up and said, "Dennis, are you sure this is true? Are you sure this is true? Do you have a good source for this?" He assured me that it was, and cited his sources. But it was it's an indicator of how awful and kind of, in a way, sort of primitive some of those early large engagements were.
So it wasn't just warfare that was industrialized. The printing press and large-scale production of propaganda seemed to have a interesting parallel to the development of also other kind of technologies of fighting war. Was this just serendipity, or?
Well, it was. No, I don't have the exact numbers. I'm not a historian of printing, but fairly high speed four color printing was well established long before the war came along, and high speed printing. Excuse me, for newspapers, which is the dominant news medium. Was pretty much a worldwide fact by the 1890s. So the ability to reach propaganda was, I mean, the starting point here, obviously, if you're looking at the book. Starting point is propaganda was enormously important and effective in marshaling public opinion, in maintaining the morale of soldiers, and denigrating and demonizing your enemies. And it was effective, I think, precisely because in the target countries, Britain, Germany, France, and especially the United States, where everybody was competing for American public opinion, it was able, the authorities and the press people were able to reach a mass audience very quickly. And that was... Yeah, that was something of a new development. I mean, it was a real factor in the success of propaganda, which it's time for a commercial for the book. I mean, you can see the effect and some very clever propaganda, and it was effective. I think just a side note, I think it's undeniable that the British exploitation of the atrocity opportunity, propaganda opportunities that they handed the Germans, both by the German army's behavior in their transit of Belgium and in the sinking of the Lusitania, was really instrumental in shifting American public opinion in favor of the Brits rather than the Germans. And don't forget, America had a very significant German immigrant population. It was a you know, a minority group, but it was a very large group, and some parts of the country, you know, decisive.
I'm guessing the world had not seen a propaganda war quite like this before.
No, I don't think so. No, this was for visual propaganda. This was really a high point, and it was conducted by the press, the, you know, more or less free press in the countries, and also by the governments. German propaganda was almost entirely a work of the German government, and the British also eventually made their propaganda efforts overt. Early on, they had in what seems like a kind of typical way to approach British way to approach things. They had a subterfuge called Wellington House that posed as an independent publishing house and was generating, you know, magazines, newspapers, stories, books, everything, and it was entirely funded by the British government. Eventually, they went public with it, but it was the subterfuge to which people were resorting in conducting the propaganda campaigns was quite interesting. One of the things I thought was particularly fascinating is that there was an established newspaper in New York, the Evening Mail, that had been around for decades, and it was secretly purchased by the German government and operated for a couple of years as a supposedly independent newspaper, but it was actually an arm of German propaganda. It wasn't exposed until 1918.
So many have heard of the movie and the book. The book was published in 1928 in Germany, All Quiet on the Western Front.
Yeah.
Most people don't know that was a German book, but it was published in 22 languages. Then the very famous American film, All Quiet on the Western Front, came out later in the 30s. And then many in America are familiar with the poem In Flanders Field, where that's where the idea of the poppy to memorialize war dead really comes from.
Yeah.
So the idea of the war being fought in Belgium and France is kind of seared into our collective memory, but the war had a lot of different fronts, in particular the Eastern Front.
Yeah, it surely did. Just the example of the Russians and the Austrians slugging it out. The Russians and the Germans also slugged it out. I would think the most important impact of the conduct of the war on the Eastern Front was the extraordinary casualties that the Russian army suffered, which badly eroded civilian morale, which in some sense, I think can be said to have led to the Russian Revolution in 1917, the collapse of the Russian army command structure and then their effectiveness, and, you know, eventually their withdrawal from the war. So, and what was, you know, what succeeded the collapse of the government, of course, was Lenin's government. So that was kind of the rise of the communist state. And, you know, the war was extensively fought in the Mediterranean, in northern and central Africa, and the Middle East. And I think it's fair to say that we're still suffering meaning practically the whole world, is still suffering the consequences of the way the fighting and the diplomacy was exercised in the Middle East. And I'm sure you're probably all familiar with the story of how, toward the end of the war, not at the end of the war, the territories of the collapsing Ottoman Empire were codified into states by a couple of a French and a British diplomat who basically, you know, drew lines on a map and said, okay, this is Syria and that's Lebanon and this is our influence and that's your influence and that's Palestine. And we're, you know, you pick up the paper today, you're still reading about the consequences of that. It was, it was over 100 years ago.
Well, as you talk about all that stuff, it also sounds strangely familiar to World War II.
Well, you know,
you're talking about where the fight was and what was going on, and fighting in Africa and fighting in the.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it is true that. But I think this is truly the first world war. I don't know if I'd really characterize it as a global war in the sense that everybody was involved, but it was certainly elements of it were fought out in some very unexpected places, all around the world. And the consequences, are ones that are still with us. So yeah,
it's not just trench lines in France.
No, it was not just trench lines in France. That's the that's kind of the stereotype. But it was also, vigorous fighting in the Middle East and the desert warfare. It wasn't invented with Rommel. There was a lot of it in World War I. Yeah.
We talked a little bit about this earlier, but I want to expand on it. The American poet Joyce Kilmer, he's a part of the American Expeditionary Force, who, if you've ever heard the poem, Lovely as a Tree, he wrote that one. Mm-hmm. He's buried in the Wissant Cemetery because he was killed in combat over there. He wrote a poem, and I'm going to read a little bit of it here. It's famous for World War I. It's called The Rouge Bouquet, and it goes, "In a wood they called the Rouge Bouquet, there is a new-made grave today, built by never a spade nor pick, yet covered with earth 10 meters thick. There they lie, many fighting men, dead in their youthful prime, never to laugh nor love again, nor taste the summertime, for death came flying through the air." And it goes on, for a while along the lines. He's really talking about the devastating effect of new technology, of bigger, more accurate guns. But it wasn't just bigger, more accurate guns that were killing men on the front.
No, the technological elements, it's a very touching poem, and it points to one of the real, horrors of the war, which is the effectiveness of artillery, which, obviously what he's describing here is being buried by an explosion. If you're familiar with the some of the monuments to the battles, the major battles, there's an enormous number of not just an unknown soldier, there are legions of unknown soldiers. There are hundreds of thousands of unknown soldiers. And the some of the monuments, especially the one at Verdun, hold the remains of, I think, something like 150,000 persons, soldiers, who were killed but never identified. You couldn't identify them because there wasn't enough left to identify them. And that's an index of the deadliness of the artillery, which is became the leading cause of death in the war. More people were killed, more soldiers were killed by artillery than any other means. But there were a lot of things. Airplanes were, as I said, kite-like. Submarines were something of a novelty, but not terribly effective. The internal combustion engine wasn't all that highly developed at the beginning of the war. And the tank, of course, didn't even exist at the beginning of the war. It was invented during the war, based on an American farm tractor, by the way. The Brits invented it. Those weapon systems went from either non-existing, as the tank did, or from a state of not being greatly effective to being highly deadly. And in the course of the war, the development of artillery, the development of the machine gun, the development of submarines, and I suppose above all the tank, which didn't prove decisive during the war, but the Brits were the leaders in this. The French also built some small tanks, but the Brits went for the heavier things, and they were initially very effective as a weapon of terror. First couple of times that they appeared on the battlefield advancing on the German lines, they really stampeded the Germans. They hadn't seen anything like it. They knew they couldn't stop it by firing at it. And the one big tank battle, which was a forerunner of tank warfare tactics that eventually developed at the Battle of Cambrai in 1917. The British mustered almost 400 tanks, which was, the Germans hardly had any. And when they did, what they did have that was effective, it was captured British tanks. But that was the first indication that armor was going to, you know, play a major battle in, if not this war, in wars of the future, because they managed to field a large number of tanks. And again, there was an initial breakthrough of the German line that was quite wide, and again, it just stampeded the Germans because they couldn't stop it. Eventually, a lot of the tanks broke down. They weren't very reliable. And having owned several British sports cars, I'm tempted to say something generic about motor vehicle quality control in England, but we'll let that one ride. We can talk about that afterward. A lot of them just broke down. But there was no doubt, I think, in anyone's mind who saw that formation that this was a, you know, roaring, clanking wave of the future.
Well, one of the reasons we picked the cover of Lest We Forget, you have men having problems with horses who are stuck in the mud, but over here on the edge, and then as you go over here, there are Model T trucks. And this is the advancing line from the Battle of San Miguel of American Expeditionary Forces going to fight the Misurgan Offensive. And if there's a picture that captures that combination of the war at that time, it really is that picture. If you carefully look at the picture in full, you can also see another line of men just mm-hmm. in line marching all the way through France on foot. So it really was this kind of combination of mechanized war and Napoleonic wars.
Yeah, exactly. And as one historian whose name I'm now forgetting pointed out that, you know, while the Germans had a fantastic railway network and they had the advantage of interior lines and they could really rush reinforcements around quite a bit, once they got off the trains, they were moving at the same pace that Caesar's legions were moving. That is, you know, this way. So, you know, the achievements and advantages of the technological advances were uneven and unevenly distributed.
But would you agree, I had heard a historian say that World War I is pretty much World War II without the nukes. Do you agree with that by the end of the war? Maybe without radar, too. We could throw that in there.
Yeah, no, I think there were too many things that really, really made a difference. You know, the submarines were really effective against merchant shipping in World War I precisely because there was once they were submerged, there was really no defense about it. You couldn't find them and you couldn't sink them. That changed in World War II. The only thing that saved the Brits was the convoy formation. But, I don't think I'd agree with that concept. The two wars were related. I do remember years ago, when I was first interested in history, that there were arguments about whether World War I really was related to World War II, and you know, was it a total different thing or what? You know, but I think it's very clear that you know, the stage was set, the weapons were on their way, the tactics were worked out. A lot of things that happened in World War I were really direct precursors of what happened in World War II, which maybe it makes it all the more tragic that didn't we already do this once, kind of thing.
Yeah. But there was more going on in the world that was new and exciting for those people who were alive back then. The flu pandemic was truly a global pandemic. Probably the only thing like it of its kind documented in human history. Mm. And the war contributed to this, didn't it?
It did. It did enormously. The flu pandemic contributed significantly in 1918 to the conduct of the war in Europe. Worldwide, there was something like 30 million people killed as far as anybody can tell. It was really hard to, you know, hard to get exact numbers on here, but that's a good ballpark figure. The Americans, sometimes the real telltale is when you can look at a smaller number. There was one training camp in the United States, in Massachusetts, right outside Boston, They were final training for guys who were going to, you know, embark for Europe. When the flu really got going, it was killing 100 soldiers a day at that camp. And the thing that was different about that particular form of influenza is it really attacked and thrived on otherwise healthy young people. It didn't just, you know, cull the herd of sick and disabled. It killed off people who were otherwise in really, you know, we would think is perfect health. And it killed people rapidly. Sometimes people went from, you know, a sniffle and a slight discoloration, and in 5 days they were dead. I mean, it was really, really deadly. And the way the war contributed to the spread of it, of course, is that it happened just precisely at the time when the American military forces, mostly the Army, were being transported in tightly packed troop ships across the Atlantic. And there are several instances of ships arriving in Europe with having had a small number of infected soldiers on board, to when they disembarked, a third of the people that came off the ship had the flu. They didn't all die, but it disabled people for a long time as well. It's killing them. And on the other side, it had a profound impact on the German forces, because by the time the flu hit, they were already suffering very considerably from the effects of the British blockade and other factors that reduced their possible, you know, caloric intake, and soldiers were really in a weakened state, and it caused a very high level of casualties. General Ludendorff himself said after the war that the flu had had a profoundly compromising effect on his series of all important to him offensives that he mounted in 1918, all of which eventually stalled. But he was fighting with a very weakened force. So it had the effects went both ways.
Let's shift over to the Americans getting into the war. I think to say that the Americans were prepared for war when it declared war would be an understatement. I would wonder if you'd illustrate some examples of just how that was the case.
Well, I think the most telling example about the lack of preparedness on the part of the American military is that our army had a total strength of about 120,000. And I've already mentioned that, you know, that's... The French had that many killed or casualties in the first battle they fought, so the scale of things, you know, begins to come in focus. The United States really didn't. The army that the United States did have was mostly experienced at kind of police actions and fighting Native Americans out west. It was not there was the Spanish-American War. It's true, but. That was a pretty amateurish operation all around, at least in terms of the Army. We just didn't have the strength. And so one of the wonders of the, if you take a step back and look at the conduct of America in entering the war, one of the real wonders was the rapidity of the mobilization. It was the start of selective service. In the United States. There was a draft in the Civil War, of course, but this was a nationwide selective service, and you had to say, there were building training camps everywhere very rapidly. I mean, there was this huge rush about everything. And so we had the manpower and we needed the time to get geared up and get people trained and get them over to Europe, you know, without having them sunk by U-boats. And by the way, no U.S. troop ship was ever sunk because they were using convoys at that time, by that time. So that was a big safeguard. And The weaponry was, the heavier weaponry was by and large furnished by the European allies, British and French artillery. Such tank activity as there was by the U.S. Army, they were largely relying on the Renault Model 17 light tank, which had a very distinctive sort of silhouette of a kind of high turret and a out of parallel caterpillar tracks. We and aircraft, you know, we had the manpower, but we didn't have the weaponry, but we did have a lot of other things. Industrial production was enormous. We sent an enormous number of vehicles. Mack, the truck manufacturer alone, sent something like 8,000 or 9,000 trucks to the war. You've probably seen the pictures of them lined up, and we were able to produce a lot of things, so that was a big big contributor, men and material.
Yeah. For many, there's this collective, again, idea of armies stuck in trenches, stalemated, and for a long time, that was pretty true,
for all
sorts of reasons, aerial reconnaissance, things like that. But the counteroffensive of the Germans late in the war and then the seemingly unprepared Americans really changed the tactics of the war late on. Tell me a little bit about how tactics changed throughout the course of the war.
Well, some things changed and some things didn't. The idea of a mass frontal attack on a heavily defended position never seems to have entirely gone away, but the Germans actually got better at defending against that than the Allies did. And the Germans, just a parenthesis here, the term stormtrooper has been applied to almost everything from heavy weapons carrying guys to out of control police departments. But it really had a specific meaning late in the war for the Germans, because they realized that they were getting kind of decimated by ever more powerful Western artillery, and they finally figured out that the way to defend against that is not put all your guys up in the front line where the artillery can kill them all, but conceive of a defense in echelon, in ranks going back miles sometimes, but out of the reach of the initial artillery barrages, which the Germans were very good at themselves, and the British had gotten very effective at. But to defend yourself by a defense in really in depth, and then And then in an attack mode, instead of a kind of massed frontal attack, first a very selective, careful artillery barrage that would involve, armor-piercing, high-explosive gas shells. The Germans got very good at mixing up those things and timing them so that they would, they'd have a thunderous artillery barrage with mostly high explosives at first, and then when the recipients were trying to recover from that, then hitting them in sequence with gas shell barrages, which would also serve to, kill the people who were already confused and to kill the people who were coming up, the medics and so on, who were coming up to treat the wounded. It was diabolically clever. And then having, instead of having a mass attack, having an attack by very carefully trained small units, those were the stormtroopers, who carried an amazing amount of firepower in the form of grenades and light machine guns, and they were not to advance slowly across the open ground the way armies had done, especially the British, in the first part of the war, but to really, to borrow the term, blitz the enemy line in small units and create havoc and encircle forward units And they tried all these tactics out in the Germans did in their attack on the Latvian city of Riga, which was defended by the Russian 12th Army. And it involved a river crossing. And the Germans rehearsed this for weeks, and they had all kinds of feints and careful moves to just confuse the Russian defenders. And then they attacked in small units. They attacked in boats at first, and then some pontoon bridges that they threw up very quickly. And it worked. I mean, they instead of a big frontal attack, they got these small units attacking in there, and they just sowed confusion everywhere. And it took them a very short time to completely defeat and basically stampede the Russian 12th Army, which in the northern sector, that really left that part of Russia undefended. And when Russia dropped out of the war, the Germans came back and they applied those same tactics in Ludendorff's famous series of five major offensives, which were effective, eventually were stalled, but were, in short term, very effective. And you know, that was the closest the Germans came to winning the war, but at that point they didn't have the manpower to sustain those specialized attacks that they were doing. So we got lucky.
So what about the Americans? They Pershing did some things that basically providing a whole fresh army to the mix was certainly a big part of it.
Yeah, and of course he was famously resistant to the idea of parceling the Americans out as replacements, which is what the British and the French especially wanted to see happen. The fact of the numbers, I think, were really overwhelming to the Germans. They had kind of shot their bolt. I mean, there was still very hard fighting, you know, right to the end, but I think it was very clear that the Germans had lost the war. Ludendorff even admitted after the last of his attacks petered out that the combination of, at that point, I've forgotten the exact number, but it's something like a couple of 100,000 American soldiers were arriving by the month. And you know, those were overwhelming numbers to the Germans. They were really at the bottom of their manpower pool. So. That was effective, and the Americans did fight hard. I think they were not always well led, and there was a lot of confusion, and there was a lot of kind of difficulty in communication with their allies once in the, you know, in the front. But that wasn't, you know, that wasn't the fault of the Americans. Their communication at the front line was almost uniformly terrible throughout the war, so that was nothing new. But anyway, the numbers told and the material told and the, you know, sheer weight of the freshness of the soldiers really was a factor.
Well, this book, Lest We Forget, the writing in it really does go from the very beginning of the war all the way to the after the war. And immediately following the war, German paramilitary militias composed of defeated German soldiers really wreaked havoc in the chaotic post-war Germany environment. And they really are seen as the literal precursors to the Nazis. And were there other areas of chaos in the world following the war?
Well, there was plenty of chaos in the world. I think it's we like our history neat for the most part, and it's entertaining to think that the shooting all stopped on November 11th, 1918, and it didn't. There was still fighting in Africa, of all places. And the situation in Russia remained quite chaotic. There were British contingents fighting in Russia, you know, after the war, well after the war. The U.S. Army was in Russia. There were American boots on the ground in Russia as late as, I believe, 1920. There's a famous story about some National Guard unit from, I forget whether it was Michigan or Wisconsin, that was stationed in the north. And they were badly led. They didn't know what to do. They were sort of trying to help the White Army as opposed to the Red Army. But there was a lot of fighting going on. There was a large number of Czechoslovakian soldiers, Czech soldiers, formed as the Czech Legion that was fighting and had sort of fought its way out of Siberia. There was a lot of chaos, and that's not unusual. You know, if you look at the broad sweep of history, you know, you could make a real serious argument that the reason the Wild West in America was the Wild West was a lot of it occurred in the direct aftermath of the Civil War, when you had a lot of very experienced fighters toting weapons, heading out west to seek their fortunes. I mean, it wasn't just it wasn't just clerks from Chicago who were going out there. It was guys who'd been fighting for 3 years ended up out there. And I don't want to get into the other stories, but the great Northfield, Minnesota raid is a case in point of the war, Civil War being fought over again. And the same thing happened in World War II. You know, again, skip to the other end of it. We think that war ended when the signing on the Missouri. Well, not exactly, because for one thing, there were 1 million Japanese under arms in China the day that thing was signed, and they didn't think they'd been defeated. And there were still, you know, a lot. I mean, George Marshall went over there and sort of talked them down, but I'm oversimplifying, obviously. But, you know, big wars, it's not just that some people down at the end of the line don't get the word. You know, chaos has been unleashed, and civil order is precarious. And you've got a lot of armed people and people who are experienced at fighting, and maybe, you know, there are a lot of young guys who don't know much else except fighting. So it's a recipe for chaos, and there was plenty of it in Germany, but there was plenty of it elsewhere as well.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for talking about what you've written for the book this evening. We're going to turn it over to taking some questions from our audience.
Okay.
I was just wondering a quick question about the mutiny of the French army.
Yes.
Could you comment on that?
Sure. The French were, you know, universally appalled and demoralized by the casualty list that started really on day one in the war and continued through, you know, these horrible bloodletting wars, you know, engagements like the one at Verdun. They were getting pretty desperate for some, you know, I mean, the whole history of the Western Front is really trying to find some way to break through, you know, that accounts for tanks and so on. Late in the war, General Nivelle thought he had convinced the French government that he had a plan for a final breakthrough and gathered an enormous force for it. And it was another bloodbath. It bogged down, it failed. And in the wake of that, first some small units and then some whole units started to they just refused to come back to the front after they may have gone home on leave or they've been taken back for medical reasons or whatever, and were supposed to report back to their units, and a whole lot of them started not reporting back. It wasn't exactly that they were walking away from the trenches, but they were not returning to the trenches. But it didn't spread nearly as far and wide as the French government and the Brits and expected it to. But what it did do was it forced a revision in the treatment of the frontline troops. They began not keeping people in battle for long stretches of time. They were rotating people out much more frequently after the mutiny, they were rotating people out. That was the major thing they did, was they rotated people out much more rapidly. They gave people furloughs and stuff much more often. And they really tried to avoid having those, total bloodbath kind of engagements. So it did have an effect, you know, and a good one, really.
So I've got a question from the internet here. This is Fritz Miller on Facebook. And he's asking something that I've wondered a lot about, so good question, Fritz. Will there come a point in time when we'll stop making a distinction between World War I and World War II, much as we have lumped together a variety of battles and skirmishes as, say, the Hundred Years' War? Because they didn't call it the Hundred Years' War when it was at year 50.
No. Although James McPherson has famously noted that we have our own Hundred Years' War that started in 1860 and arguably ended with the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964. And I would argue, actually, that it's still going on. Just a prayer note. I think that there's, I alluded to that a little earlier, I think there has been a movement, my sense is that there's been a movement toward seeing them as very closely related major events. That I wouldn't say that you can say that they were all one big war, but it's you can certainly make a convincing case that they're very tightly linked. So
that where Churchill got his start as a newspaper man and started writing in the First World War.
He was beyond that. He was in the government in the First World War. He was a reporter and made his reputation as a swashbuckling, you know, pistol-carrying guy in the Boer War. And so he was at it earlier than that. Yeah, in South Africa, yeah. And he was an adventurer in other places as well, yeah.
You started this out with something we hear a lot, that there were these new weapons and the militaries didn't know what the implications would be, yep. And sort of the mass killing becomes kind of a mistake. Gee, we didn't get it right. Michael Howard wrote an article that was published in a book edited by Peter Paré, who we'll get here in a minute, mm-hmm. and called Men Against Fire. And Men Against Fire. It's in Makers of Modern Strategy.
Yeah, okay.
And his argument is that not everybody, but a significant amount of the officers who were planning, you know, before World War I, had taken account of the tremendous losses of the Russo-Japanese War,
yeah. mm-hmm.
that they knew the killing potential of these new weapons, but they just couldn't figure out a way about how you get from here to here without having to deal with those with the impact of their weapons. And I recall it was one English author who, in fact, was a translator of Clausewitz, but I can't remember his name, says, if we train people not to die, then we can't win the war. We need people
right.
who are trained to die.
Right.
And when I'm not saying everybody was like that. Grand Maison, I don't think, ever said
yeah.
that. But it turns it into not an act of stupidity, but an act of calculation. We have to get these guys up. It's so awful, we have to stand them up so they can be supervised, because if we hit the ground, they'll never get up again.
Right.
And so, in fact, it was they didn't perhaps understand how many people were going to die, but they knew it was going to be unprecedented calculation, mm-hmm. Death, and that... This was the price of being a great nation. The Japanese paid that terrible price,
they
and they came out a
Absolutely.
Great nation. We've got
Absolutely.
To do the same thing. And that makes World War I even more horrifying.
It does. And I didn't mean to... there's a caveat, you know, yeah. with all this. If you turn it around and say, okay, you know, put yourself in the position of a Douglas Haig or somebody who's facing 400 miles of fortified trenches... from Switzerland to the North Sea, and you want to crack that line in a decisive way, and that allows you to sort of outflank them maybe and roll up a whole army or two. I wouldn't defend the kind of slaughterhouse tactics, but it's hard to think of an alternative. It really is hard to think of an alternative. I mean, I think Haig was wrong about, you know, a lot of things. But, to me, the one really good faith effort to break that pattern was the invention and deployment of the tank. They were really, that was the whole point. They were really trying to, blow a, wedge into the German lines that the Germans couldn't replace or repair fast enough. And they could, it could be decisive. it wasn't decisive, but you know, it's arguable that it wasn't decisive because communications were so poor that they didn't have the manpower mustered to follow up at Cambrai particularly. They didn't have the manpower mustered to blow through that gap that they had in fact created. And you know, when you take that one away, then you think, well, what's the answer? Air power? Well, not really. I mean, it was great for reconnaissance and bombers were getting better and better. But, you know, we've since learned some very hard lessons about how successful strategic bombing alone can be. So, you know, even if we'd had better aircraft, that might not have been much of an answer either. So, I don't know. You almost have to look, you know, I mean, Churchill, you know, just to extend this a little, Churchill was the driving force behind Gallipoli. And his idea, as I understand it, his idea was to open another completely different front that would put pressure on the Germans that would cause them to, you know, reduce their strength on the Western Front. It didn't, you know, for many reasons, it didn't work. But people were thinking about that. But, you know, honestly, nobody came up with a real good answer. And you know, maybe the answer was, well, let me put it this way. It's not just Clausewitz and Sun Tzu that think this, but you know, there are basically three ways to defeat an enemy. You either kill all the soldiers, you conquer their territory, or you destroy the will to resist. And you know, that war wasn't over until Germany was really on the ropes and was not a combination of manpower, weaponry, you know, political will on the home front. They weren't able to continue the war. Individual soldiers thought they were, but as a country, they were not. So nobody had a good answer to the Western Front, is the bottom line. Yeah.
You can actually find a publication by the former, or then retired, chief of the German General Staff, von Schlieffen, in 1909, that gives a completely accurate picture of the Western Front that was going to be. And his answer is, will we ever see such a war? No. Politicians will not allow us to engage in a war for very long that will kill millions and cost billions, I am quoting. So that gets us back to the politicians and the question of who was responsible for the Great War. As you know, one of the most tortured questions in the First World War is historiography.
Yeah. Yeah.
So given the fact that now we have, for example, Christopher Clark's work that suggests that maybe the Germans weren't all to blame, and maybe some of the blame should be assigned to the French and the Russians. Where do you come out on this on that particular question?
Oh, well, my read of it is that yes, there was a strong current of kind of rabid nationalism in quite a few of these countries. Germany, because they had basically just united as a country not too long before all this happened. Same in a sense with Italy. In the Balkans, there were a lot of contenders for, you know, who was going to pick up the pieces as the Austro-Hungarian, you know, empire was visibly collapsing. And the same with the Ottoman Empire. So there was a lot of nationalism. The Germans were the only ones that you know, had a strong militant, you know, or military streak in their public affairs. Although Kaiser Wilhelm was kind of in a class by himself with this stuff. I mean, look at those uniforms, you know. But yeah, I think there's enough blame to go around. But I think the real, you know, if I'm using the term correctly, the real proximate cause of the war has to be laid at the feet of the Germans. Because I think, you know, if they hadn't at the beginning of the war, when Austria was on fire to go after the Serbs, if they hadn't essentially given the Serbs a diplomatic and military blank check, maybe a military and a political blank check, maybe Austria wouldn't have declared war on the Serbs. Maybe they would, maybe they wouldn't. But once they knew they had the backing of Germany, you know, it was irresistible to them. So I come out on the side as it's kind of, you know, it's mostly the Germans who kicked it off, but you can make a case that there were a lot of complicit players. People, you know, and it's a fact that there, you know, not enough of the civilian populations were cognizant of the effects of warfare for a couple of generations there. Yeah, the Franco-Prussian War was pretty bad, but it was short and it didn't affect everybody. But, you know, it's a sort of, it's a dangerous situation where you've got a lot of kind of military-leaning nations with a lot of rabid nationalism floating around and a lot of people who don't know what it's like to be in a war. They start getting funny ideas about it. You know, it's a social Darwin kind of ideas. It's a manly thing to do. We're going to, you know, go out and kick those guys. That's high risk. And there was enough of that going around that the Germans are not entirely the cause of all this, in my view. Anyway.
We're going to do one more question.
You touched on this a couple minutes ago regarding Gallipoli. And Churchill certainly took the blame for it. In your research, was that reasonable that the government and the populace should have held him responsible, or was this something beyond his control?
I don't know the extent of his control on that, but it's, you know, in situations like that, there's plenty of blame to go around. I mean, the planning of the landing, the landings at Gallipoli, and the intelligence about the Turkish defenders and the obvious disposition of the Turkish defenders, you know, should have been a big red flag, but or warning light. But you know, they went ahead anyway. You know, how much of that was tactical command on site, and how much of it was higher level planning by you know, the naval people in back in England. I don't really know. But yeah, Churchill took the fall for it, but. He was pushing for it pretty hard.
Well, Michael, thank you very much.
Sure.
For a wonderful conversation.
Thank you all.
Thank you very much. Thank you to Michael Robbins for this outstanding discussion. And to BMO Wealth Management, Tyrone and Ann Fainer, Yon LLC, Reed Smith, the Satter Foundation, and the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund for sponsoring this program. The book is Lest We Forget, The Great War, published by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in partnership with the United States World War I Centennial Commission. The book features an introduction by the world's leading scholar on World War I, Sir Hugh Strawn. It has a foreword by the Museum and Library's founder and chair, Colonel Illinois Jennifer N. Pritzker, Illinois Army National Guard retired, and an afterword by Colonel Robert D'Alessandro, U.S. Army retired, acting chair of the American Battle Monuments Commission. The book is now available at PritzkerMilitary.org, Amazon.com, or at your local bookseller. To visit the exhibition, Lest We Forget, Sailors, Sammies, and Doughboys over there in World War I, visit the museum and library in person or view online at PritzkerMilitary.org/World War I. Thank you, and please join us next time on Pritzker Military Presents.
Visit the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago. Explore original exhibits on military history or be a part of a live studio audience. Watch other episodes of Pritzker Military Presents. Find out what's on at PritzkerMilitary.org. Pritzker Military Presents is made possible by members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library and its sponsors. The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the museum and library.
Mm-hmm.
The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.